see.
Jill Wolf, age 35. Today is January 22nd, 2015. I'm at the Chicago Cultural Center, and I'm with my friend and fellow advocate, Naveen.
My name is Naveen Vij. I am 31 years old. Today is January 22nd, 2015. I, too, am at the Cultural Center in Chicago, Illinois, and I'm sitting here with my friend and fellow champion of hepatitis C, Jill Wolf.
Naveen, I'm so excited that you're here from Middle America, Ohio, but I'm curious, where do you come from?
that's a pretty heavy question.
It is. Take that wherever you'd like.
So I think to really share my story, you have to go back to the summer of 1983. It was close to the last week in June, and I had hit approximately maybe 29, 30 weeks of development in my mom's belly. Turns out I didn't want to stay in anymore, so managed to drive up my mom's blood pressure, and I got my wishes. And I was delivered early as a premature baby on June 22nd, 1983.
At 29 weeks.
A little over 29 weeks, I believe. So I subsequently spent the next several months in the neonatal ICU in Minneapolis. Chest x-rays, breathing tubes, blood transfusions, blood draws, all of that ensued. And, you know, as I got older, I had opportunity to talk to my mom a bit more about that whole experience. And what I learned was not only was I kind of sitting through that, but more importantly, she was too. And people used to turn to her and ask her this question, how could this happen, or what are you going to do? And true to my mom, who that she was, she used to kind of shrug and with a smile say, you know, everything happens for a reason in life, and the challenge in good and bad is to figure out why. And so when I think back on my life and I think back on that summer of 1983, I keep coming back to that phrase, everything happens for a reason in life, and the challenge in good and bad is to find out why. Fast forward about 27 years later, and after growing up in Minnesota, a stint in Chicago, and then going to college and medical school down in Houston, Texas, I moved to Cleveland, Ohio, where I began my residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at Case Western. During my intern year, I had just completed up a 30-hour shift, and I found myself sitting in employee health services at University Hospitals in Cleveland. I reluctantly had entered up there. Turns out the night before, while doing a procedure, I got needle stuck. So one of the colleagues I was working with strongly encouraged me to go to employee health. This is the right thing to do. This is standard procedure.
What was your hesitancy?
I was tired.
30 hours of work.
30 hours of work, yeah. I just wanted my bed. Yeah. I wanted my pillow. And wanted my jammies on. But I listened to him, and so I went to employee health and got my blood drawn and really kind of just wanted to get home and pick up an Egg McMuffin on the way to eaten and pass out, which I did. A few days later, I got a phone call that forever changed my life. You have hepatitis C, I was told. I remember standing in a hallway at the hospital, and I nearly dropped my phone. I felt like my world stopped. Immediately, the questions kind of abounded in my head. What does this mean? How could this be? Is this right? Do I have cirrhosis? Am I going to need a liver transplant? Am I going to die? Can I even work anymore? Can I be a physician? How do I tell my family, my friends, my girlfriend? You know, I think all of us who work in healthcare, a little information and a little bit of experience is sometimes a dangerous thing. And I didn't know what to do with it. I was scared. I was terrified. I remember calling my mom and talking to her about what was happening. And I'm kind of the black sheep in my family. I'm the only one in medicine. And I can remember hearing not only how scared she was, potentially, but how reassured she was, too. And there was that phrase that kept coming back. You know, Beta, she said, you know, everything happens for a reason in life. And we'll figure out why.
Beta?
Yeah, it means, it's a term of endearment in Hindi. It means son. So, fast forward a little bit.
You were in Ohio when you found this. Where? Mom was in Minnesota?
In Chicago.
In Chicago.
Yeah. So, about a week after I graduated from high school in 2001, my family moved here to Chicago. So mom and dad and my brother were here in Chicago. So fast forward to July 2010, probably about a week after my birthday, I gave myself my first injection of interferon and took my first ribavirin pills, which were, you know, standard therapy for hepatitis C treatment at the time. Over the next 6 months, I would come to learn pretty quickly about the side effects and consequences and complications of therapy that, unfortunately, a lot of my own patients had experienced. There were the days of feeling delirious, depressed, dehydrated, pretty confused. There were the days of feeling fatigued, tired, not wanting to do anything, not wanting to go to work.
Oh, while still working.
While still working. Doing, you know, 30-hour calls every 4 days at times. But, you know, through that process, I kept working because, you know, to me, there was this other phrase that my mom used to tell me. And it's funny, as you get older, you know, when you're growing up in high school, middle school, like every mom out there has their set of phrases. I don't know where they come from, but maybe it's just life experiences that...
They're little nuggets of wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was always dropping little nuggets of wisdom on me left and right, which at the time never made sense. Mm. But as you go through things in life and you go through experiences and you have perspective, right, you go through good and bad, those nuggets of wisdom become completely true. And one of the other things that she used to tell me is that, you know, life is sort of 10% what we're given and 90% how we deal with things. And that's something I saw in her. You know, I talk a lot about my mom, but she was really... she was my life. She was my role model, my inspiration. She's where I got my laugh and my, what I think are horrible dance moves. and my smile as well too. But beyond that too, it's where I got my approach towards living life. And so when I look back on those 6 months, you know, there was good days, bad days, days of being neutropenic where my white blood cell count was low. I got the ribavirin rash, which for anyone who's been through ribavirin before, it's this really itchy red rash. I remember going to CVS and picking up a bunch of Sarno lotion. I'm pretty sure the dude working behind the counter thought I had like a case of bed bugs or something. But I was fortunate to have, you know, people by my side. And I had my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, Abby there, who was my rock. And I got through it. And unfortunately, about a week after I completed my treatment in December, my mom, who had been battling her own set of illnesses, was found to be in a minimally conscious state here in Chicago. My mom had 3 different cancers over her lifetime. She had breast when I was in high school, thyroid later on, and then she had developed squamous cell carcinoma, or cancer of the mouth. And she had a recurrence around the time where I started treatment. And she was being treated here in Chicago, and she had a lot of side effects from the treatment. You know, anyone who's been through chemotherapy knows it's tough stuff. She had the tough stuff, but then even tougher stuff along the way. And about a week after I finished my last dose of interferon in Cleveland, I came back to Chicago, and my mom had sustained brain damage from the chemotherapy. She was left in what's called a minimally conscious state. The next 6 months were kind of their own bittersweet set of challenges. Time in the ICU, the neuro ICU, transfers to RIC, Rehab Institute of Chicago, to community hospital, dealing with kind of, the horrors of home health care, looking at skilled nursing facilities. And, she unfortunately never regained, a lot of her neurologic function. She was kind of 24-hour day, 7 day a week, bed-bound and entirely dependent on a feeding tube, a urine catheter, and the help of us and caregivers to take care of her. And during that process, what kept coming back to me too is, you know, my mom's phrase. You know, everything happens for a reason, and the challenge in good and bad is to find out why. But it was hard to find out why.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's hard as a person not questioning why me, why this, how come, right? I looked at my mom's own situation, why three cancers, why this, why, you know, for someone so vibrant, dynamic.
Wise,
right? But I think what I've learned through that year is really there's only so much control over situations we have. But the biggest control that we have is over how we deal with things. I couldn't change what happened to her. I couldn't change what happened to me. But I was fortunate. You know, I was lucky to get needle stuck and find out my diagnosis.
Were you ever angry?
No. Because who was there to be angry with? I think, you know, it's interesting being a physician and having been a patient. You know, I spent so much of my life learning about reason and logic and physiology and understanding, you know, point A leading to point B, leading to point C. And, you know, part of that approach has been that people, you know, adults and less commonly kids, either chose certain behaviors, right? You know, they smoked and drank for 50 years, or, you know, they did drugs back in the day, or they used IV drugs at some point. Maybe they engaged in risky sexual behavior.
Maybe they ate McDonald's every day, or maybe, whatever, yeah. Poor choice, yeah.
Right. And the thing I realized, though, is that when we ascribe the word blame, I think, to our patients, we're doing ourselves a disservice, and more importantly, we're doing them a disservice. We're all people. We make choices, good and bad. Everyone does. There's a lot of things, though, that we don't choose. And the point is that neither one of those things really matters. You know, what matters is sort of getting to this point and what you do with it. So going back to, you know, my mom's situation, you know, from January 2011 to eventually June 2011, she was left in this minimally conscious state. And, you know, it was a struggle, to be perfectly frank with you, within my family, external to my family. There was a financial toll, fundraising to help pay for her care. You know, anyone who's dealt with long-term care, you learn a lot about the health insurance industry. You learn about our healthcare industry and
the business.
The business of medicine, right? Yeah. You know, whether it's the nursing homes, the insurance companies denying certain care. I think, you know, businesses and groups run based off of a certain bottom line, and they have to, right? That's just a part of the way the system is. But there are a lot of unintended consequences in the process, and, you know, these are people's lives. That was my mom's life. That was our life.
Why did you become a doctor?
I simply put, I just wanted to help people. And when I was a kid, I was always fascinated by science. I was fascinated by the way the body worked. You know, there's the stereotype of another Indian doctor, right? Like, as an Indian kid, what were my options? To become a physician, computer engineer, or maybe open a convenience store, right? I'm kidding.
Yes.
But, you know, my parents never put any pressure on me, yes, to think about medicine. It's just something that I always thought about from young childhood. I had an older cousin who's was kind of a role model for me and my family. He's a physician, too. He was the first physician in our family. We're the only two physicians in my mom's side of the family. But it was just this, as I was able to volunteer in a hospital in high school, and I think what I learned through that process, and then even college and eventually into med school from an amalgam of experiences, like whether it's even political science, studying abroad, taking humanities classes, religious studies classes. Health and disease are the great equalizers in life, right? It doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are, black, white, brown, purple. Disease is disease. Yeah. You know, hepatitis C is hepatitis C, right? I'm a face of hepatitis C as much as the stereotype of an IV drug user is. And the point is, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I thought about, you know, going into medicine as a kid and getting older, you know, there was a fascination with the science and how the body worked. But then it took on this other aspect, too, that, you know, disease and health represented so much more to the fundamental of who we are as people. You know, a diagnosis like hepatitis C carries so much weight with it, whether that's the emotional, the physical, the financial, the spiritual, right? How you look at yourself, how you think about yourself in relation to maybe your own God, maybe your own mortality, maybe your wife, your girlfriend, the people around you.
And just like your mother situation where her illness affected all of you and was really all of your life. And same with your diagnosis, and that this was something that your partner at the time, girlfriend now, wife, Abby, and your mother were experiencing right along with you. And I'm curious what, you know, the bond that you and your mom had, mm-hmm. how do you remember her taking care of you from a distance while you were going through those 6 months?
You know, it's funny what we do with our loved ones. The people we love the most, we want to burden the least, right?
Yes.
And I think during those 6 months when I was going through treatment from June 2010 to December 2010, there was plenty of times where I minimized what was going on. You know, I knew, you know, my mama had her own set of issues to deal with, and as a kid, I never wanted to burden her. I was fortunate to have Abby in my life. She was my rock, and she is my rock. Not everyone's fortunate to have that, but, you know, my journey, you know, this backpack of hepatitis C I carried was sometimes passed around, right, to other people, yeah. to people in my life. But moms know. And there's this sort of telepathic higher power understanding that every mom has about their kids. And she knew. And there was plenty of days where I wouldn't tell her what was going on, but she could hear it in my voice. She could sense it in what I was saying or wasn't saying. And she would reassure me, you know, everything's gonna be fine.
When you told Abby about your diagnosis, what was her first reaction, or how did she feel about everything?
She, true to who she is, was loving. She said, "We will get through this. We will get through this. I'm here by your side." And I can't even tell you how much, you know, that backpack that I was wearing got a little bit lighter, it turned out. Because, you know, no one goes through their journey with disease alone, right? It like you said, it's a cascade effect. It's the secondary consequences of what it does to us and to the people around us. And but I was scared to tell her, right? I mean, I think as a physician, you know, there's this stigma around hepatitis C. You know, I didn't talk about it with very many people because I was scared. I was scared of what were people going to think of me. But I look back on it, and I'm like, why the hell was I scared? Who cares, right?
But that was very real and is very real for a lot of people.
It totally is. I saw it in my own patients. I mean, patients had told me that I had taken care of. You know, they didn't tell their loved ones. They didn't tell the people they were with. They didn't tell friends what they were dealing with or going through, or why they were so tired, or why they lost their hair, or why, you know, they just didn't feel like coming out and, you know, going for a drink.
And were you then treating patients while you were being treated as well?
Yeah.
How did that influence your process of coming out, if you will?
In many ways, you know, it took me a while to be at a point in my life where I was comfortable fully talking about it. And that's only been recently. And it's actually been experiences post-treatment that have kind of allowed me to come out about my hepatitis C. You know, at the time, I didn't know what would happen. I think, you know, it's interesting. The fear of uncertainty is a really powerful fear.
what's going to happen? Am I going to get cured? Am I not going to get cured? Am I going to get through treatment? Can I do this? These are things that patients were directly telling me about their own journeys, whether it was with cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and even hepatitis C. And I think my own fear of the unknown, of what the outcome would be of this, at times paralyzed me from being open about it at that time. I was lucky. You know, I got the needle stick. I had a good genotype that was responsive to treatment. In June 2011, I mentioned my mom was in minimally conscious state, and she unfortunately had recurrence of her cancer, and through a whole series of second opinions and a lot of family drama, we had taken her home with hospice, and she passed away at home on June 17th. A few weeks later, I was back in Cleveland and meeting with my hepatitis C team, my nurse practitioner, and I got my...
Your team is in who you worked with or who were treating you?
Who were treating me.
Okay.
And I got my labs checked, and lo and behold, I was cured of hepatitis C. I had a sustained biological response. I was cured. It was the most bittersweet time in my life, you know, that whole year of ups and downs. And I think I struggled a lot in the months after, dealing with the loss of my mom, but not the loss of her, but the journey that led to that, and in context of my own hepatitis C journey. And I think as I thought about it more, and as I thought about trying to find meaning in that process, as I became more comfortable with that and this idea of paying it forward, of, you know, I was lucky to find out my diagnosis. You know, close to 75% by some estimates of patients with hepatitis C in this country don't know. That's wrong. We have to do a better job. We have to help people get screened. We have to help people understand that this is beatable. This is curable. There's so much hope in today's world. And in the last, I think, you know, several months, as I've taken care of more patients and those with hep C, those with other types of diseases, I've really realized that, you know, as people and as medical providers and as patients and as friends and as family and as colleagues of people dealing with, you know, different diseases, we don't move things forward unless we speak about it, right? You know, until you dialogue, until you come out, mm-hmm. if you will.
Bust that stigma.
Yeah. You know, let's break it down.
Yeah. So, I mean, what a unique position you're in, that with all of these sort of journeys culminating and being a physician, being a patient, being cured, these nuggets that your mother has just, you know, it's like your freckles on your face, like they'll never go away. What do you do with this? I mean, what's your next, I mean, I can't ask you where you're going to be next year, you may not know, but today, you know, as a physician, as a patient, what's your vision of the problem? How do we change this? Where do we go from here?
So I think there's really, I think, a couple things that we have to do. Number one, we have to talk about it. You know, as patients, as physicians, as friends and family, the world of Hep C today is completely different than it was 5 years ago. It's completely different than when it was 4 years ago. And I think we have to educate each other about that reality, that, you know, patients who do know of their diagnosis have been fearful of going through the treatment, right? Feel fearful of the side effects that I went through, and I don't blame them. But those fears are unfounded anymore. You know, there's new treatments on the market that have minimal side effects that can cure this disease. But we have to educate each other. We have to talk about it more. Beyond that, we have to do a better job of screening. You know, if we say that 50 to 75% of patients simply don't know in this country, that's awful. You know, it doesn't matter what your lifestyle choices were. It doesn't matter what your medical exposures were. What matters is simply knowing. Information is empowering. And although we have these great treatments that exist in today's world, you have to bridge that people to it. And the bridge to it is simply the first step of knowing. So we have to do a better job of screening people. And then beyond that too, I think, you know, there's so much involved with the socioeconomics around this, about the finances around this. Of, you know, it's true that there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, the financial challenges of being able to pay for hep C treatments, and, you know, is it a fair price, not fair price, will Medicaid cover things in this state, that state, et cetera. We have to have open and honest conversations, but they have to be around facts. We have to let facts dictate, you know, how we approach this disease. And beyond sort of, you know, talking about the socioeconomics about it, we can't let people go through this journey alone. I was lucky, like I said. You know, I had Abby, I had good friends, I had a program and an employment that was fully supportive. Not everybody's so lucky, but they're not alone. They have people. They have people like me who they can turn to get through their own journey and to wear that backpack from time to time, you know?
Unfortunately, we don't have Abby here at the table with us to have her speak for herself. But in your words, as the person closest to her, speak to me a little bit about what your wife, a family member who is not living with the virus, they are, but not in their body. Mm-hmm. What was her experience like? What do you imagine, you know, she went through?
I think she was scared. You know, we talked about it a bit, actually, you know, in retrospect, and even sometimes during those 6 months. I think at times she felt scared and helpless. You know, we all struggle for control over whatever it is in life, right? Like, we want to control over our day. We want to know what's going to happen, like, you know, what time this meeting is going to happen, what time I'm going to be home for dinner, what are we eating for dinner? Think about disease. Like, it's one of the things that we have sometimes at least control over, like whether that's cancer or hep C or HIV or whatever the case may be. And that fear of the unknown is even more fearful for those you love.
Well, you're both medical providers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did that change your experience? I know you talked a bit about some of the fear of coming out and the stigma within just your own profession, but sometimes knowing too much, I would imagine, in this kind of situation may not be so helpful.
No. You know, I think the fear of the unknown, but some of the known about hep C, right? Like the number one cause for liver transplants in the United States, you know, cirrhosis, the complications of cirrhosis, even the known side effects of the treatment journey. You know, am I going to be neutropenic next week, or am I going to be depressed? You know, am I going to feel more down about what's going on, or am I going to be dehydrated? The one of the things that I think having her there, and, you know, she's a nurse practitioner, but for both of us, that we learned from that journey together was just how much education has to happen, even for medical providers. I remember Abby coming home one day from work, and at that time she was working as a nurse in the intensive care unit, and there was a patient who had hepatitis C that they were taking care of, and one of the other medical providers had sort of chastised someone for touching the bed rail without gloves on. Oh, you can get hepatitis C that way. What? Really? I mean, this is
unless
someone...
you have an open cut on your hand and you get that blood and you squish it in there, right? That's a very specific circumstance there.
It's like a very, very specific circumstance. Yeah. And so I think, you know, we both had this conversation, and we still have this conversation too about, you know, where do we go from here in terms of helping others understand the true facts about things and the realities of hepatitis C, of what does it mean and how do you get it actually? And you know what? It's curable. You know, I think, you know, physicians from 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, the understanding about what living with hep C meant is completely different. And even just getting over some of those misconceptions, I think, is incredibly important.
Do you think, but for you having hep C, do you think that you would have the kind of passion for it that you do now, or obviously a different vision you'd have, but would there still be a fire lit?
Probably not. You know, I think about that phrase, you know, everything happens for a reason, and this was my something happened for a reason. This you know, I went through that journey, and I was lucky, and I feel lucky to know. I feel lucky to have been treated. I feel lucky to be cured, but I feel lucky to be in a position to help somebody else, and to help hopefully change, you know, the game of Hep C.
Well, I'm with you to change it, so.
I know.
We can.
We will.
We will, no we question. Will. How has your experience of living with a disease and being cured changed you as how you practice medicine?
I think it's completely further, it's further impressed upon me the importance of how we think about disease. So, you know, I mentioned that, you know, before any of this stuff happened, I a wide variety of experiences, you know, from college, med school, high school, had always left me with this concept of medicine as really kind of more than just the disease, right? Medicine and healthcare and what it means to go to the doctor are very like fundamental things that encompass more than just a disease state, right? Anyone who gets sick, when they come to the clinic, when they come to the ER, when they come to the hospital, when they come to a physician's office, they're coming to that place with a certain sense of hope, right? It may be as simple as a cold, right? A mom bringing her 6-month-old kid in at 3 o'clock in the morning to the ER and like, why is she bringing the kid in at 6 o'clock, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning with a cold? And it's because she hopes that that thing that she loves, that person that she loves can be better, can, you know, that this process too shall pass, as they say. And from my own journey, through the side effects, through the stigma, through thinking about my own sense of, I guess, morbidity and mortality, you know, I've come to recognize how more important it is that we allow, you know, the physician-patient relationship to blossom more. That we listen to our patients and beyond just, you know, the disease, to who they are, to what this disease has done to them, to their family, to their loved ones, to how they think about things. And I like to think that, you know, those elements are a part of who I am as a physician, and they are undoubtedly. And so how I think about every patient interaction is different. It's totally different. It's more... it's deeper, you know, it's more intimate, it's more than disease, you know.
Thank you for that. I mean, as a social worker, we would call that person and environment,
yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. How is that disease impacting in their body or the relationship where they live, all these things. How has your journey changed or impacted the way you are as a patient?
It's it's made me more patient. That's the word patience, right? I think I've learned, you know, 10 years ago, when I was thinking about if I'd get sick or this or that, people want an outcome right away, right? Like, I want to know this today. I want to know, am I going to be better today? But sometimes you just kind of have to life be organic and roll with it. You know, you just take it one day at a time. And the same is true for, you know, what I went through and what a lot of other people go through, that you just kind of have to take it one day at a time. And so, you know, again, my mom being right that life is sometimes 10% what we're given and 90% how we deal with it. It's so true. You know, I could only sometimes focus on that day and what, you know, my 90% was to that day, which means making it the best damn day that I had, you know, or making tomorrow the best damn day I had. I didn't know necessarily what the next week would bring, or even 3 months down the road would bring. And I think that that year as a patient taught me that a lot, because there was that waiting game, right? Like, I remember, you know, I completed treatment in December 2010, and I had to wait 6 months to get, you know, my labs checked again. And I was like, well, why can't it be 6 months from now? Why can't it be? But strangely enough, you know, life was sidetracked a little bit, unfortunately, to a different journey with my mom. And that was as much sort of feeling like being a patient along the way,
yeah,
and really taking each day for what it's worth. I mean, it's corny. We hear this all the time, right? Like, make the best out of today, for we don't know what tomorrow brings. And man, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. How has your experience changed as a husband?
I'd like to say that I think I'm pretty awesome.
You are. You're not just my kidding. Husband, but yeah. No, you're not. You're totally awesome. You're a badass, Naveen.
Well, I'm pretty sure Abby would tell you I have listening problems as much as the next guy.
What?
See what you did there.
What?
I don't know. I mean, I've only been a husband for about 6 months, but I think, you know, I've learned that relationships are a constant work in process.
You know, the number six is coming up in ridiculous ways in your life. Do you realize that?
It's the third time, I think. You know, it's the third set of 6 months.
It might be the fourth.
Probably.
I mean, there's just 6 months.
Is anyone keeping track of this right now?
I'm keeping tally right here. Is six your favorite number by chance?
I don't have a favorite number. But apparently
keep track
it's
of that
there.
Six thing. Yeah, something's there.
I'm going to tuck
there.
That away.
I want to talk about your mom, if that's cool, and we can kind of finish up, because I'm a mama's girl. You're a mama's
clearly
boy.
I am a mama's boy.
And that maternal-child relationship is just so powerful. And I thank your mom. I love your mom. I'd like you to send me a picture of her, because I can see her, but I can't. What's she doing right now? What is she, she looks down on her, what was the wonderful term that you used?
Beta.
Yes. Yeah. She looks down at hers. What is she seeing? What's she doing?
She's probably dancing right now or laughing. My mom, was just full of life. She had this zest to life that I think you could call it. And, I think she had some pretty good dance moves too. She loved hearing new music. One of her favorite things, so back when I was in college, so college is like a pretty formative time in your life.
Yeah.
And for me, college was incredibly formative in many ways, like meeting tons of new people, having new experiences.
Being in Texas. That in itself is an experience, right?
I'm sure people from Texas would agree. Having been a Midwestern boy. I did learn to say y'all, and I still drop it from time to time. It's been known to happen.
Your hair's not too big, though.
And I don't own a pair of boots either, so that didn't happen. I'm sorry, Texas.
It's okay. You weren't the convenience store owner either.
Yeah,
so
exactly. Just trying to buck some trends.
Right.
Like I said, I was a black sheep, right? So, but one of my mom's favorite things was when I would come home from breaks, like I would have a new CD of music. And she used to get frustrated with, like, my dad or my brother because they weren't the ones to bring in new music to the house. So I'd, like, have a new CD of new Indian music or Bhangra music or whatever the case may be. And so she'd jam out, too, in the car.
Nice.
So I'd like to think, you know, wherever she is right now, she's probably having a good time, having a ball and still, if you allow me to say, kicking ass.
Yeah.
Because that's who she was. She was, my mom was a, you know, at my mom's funeral and cremation, my uncle, my mom's eldest brother, had given one of the speeches, and one of the things I remember him talking about so distinctly was just that my mom kind of marched to the beat of her own drum. So, you know, she grew up in India, in New Delhi. She had a wonderful family, which I'm blessed with, you know, five brothers and sisters, and very close-knit. But she always wanted to do things a little bit differently. So while other women would wear salwar kameez or traditional Indian clothing, she wanted to wear pants. She wanted to dress Western. So she commissioned her sisters to look at these old-school Russian fashion magazines, and they would make clothes for her. You know, not very many women at that time wanted to become engineers. And, you know, she became a civil engineer, graduated the top of her class. She moved to the United States on her own, got a job with Hewlett Packard, and brought my dad over later on. And she was always, I think that spirit of independence, of never giving up on your dreams, of never giving up on that voice inside of you, right, to keep pushing, to keep going. And I think her life showed that. I mean, 3 different cancers over her lifetime, and she still would get up with a smile and say, hey, let's keep doing it.
I think you know this, but at least I'm going to reflect this back to you as someone who hasn't known you all that long, but truly loves you. She lived, you just carry on her legacy. I mean, she's here in this room with us, in your eyes, in the work that you do, in the your own beat of your own drum, and you're a badass.
Well, I think it's the greatest, you know, honor to hear that, but I'm lucky. I'm lucky I had, you know, the mom I did. I really, I mean, every kid's lucky to have the mom that they do. I just think I'm a little bit luckier in the next one, but you know, if there's anything I can do to continue on her legacy, to continue to change things for the better, that's what I want to do.
And you are.
Thanks.
Keep on keeping on. Thanks for coming to Chicago.
Thanks for thanks for having me. Thanks for taking me to the little goat.
All right, well, this is a lifetime friendship here, you realize, right? You can't get rid of me.
My brother from another mother, as they would say, right?
Yeah. Awesome.